Welcome to the Non-Breaking Space Show. From Austin, Texas, I'm Christopher Schmidt. And on today's show, we talk with Steve Portigal. Steve Portigal is the founder and principal of Portigal Consulting, a boutique firm that brings together user research, design, and business strategy. Steve is the author of Interviewing Users, How to Uncover Compelling Insights, as well as the author of Doorbells, Danger, and Dead Batteries, User Research War Stories. Before we get started, some things I'd like you to know. Make plans for CSS DevConf 2017. Join Chris Coyer, Wes Boss, Mina Markham, Harry Roberts, Sarah Drasner, Estelle Weil, and many more in New Orleans this October. Early bird tickets are on sale at cssdevconf.com. UX Design Newsletter is a weekly list of articles, tutorials, and inspiration handpicked by yours truly. Sign up at uxdesignnewsletter.com and have the best links of the week sent to your email. Set it and forget it with the Non-Breaking Space Show newsletter. Whenever a new show is ready, be prepared and be notified in your inbox by signing up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. Also, you can find show notes and links discussed in today's episode with Steve Portigal at nonbreakingspace.tv. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at Telejct, T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T. As always, if you like the show, please tell others to look for it on iTunes. That helps us spread the word immensely. Now, on with the show. Well, thank you, Steve, for joining us today. So this is a collection of stories that you collected over the years. And actually, the earliest one I could find was like that you mentioned was like you published was in 2012, I believe it was. What made you decide to start like publishing these stories from the field? Well,
yeah, you know, it's something I've been looking to do for a long, long time. I think I describe in the book the experience of being at a bar at a conference and sort of being early in my career and meeting other people just casually, having those conversations like you do. And people started telling stories of just, oh, this happened. And it was like a little moment, but it was kind of profound. I realized, oh, there's this thing that we don't talk about, that it's not just me that this happens to. Like, this is what the professional community experiences. If you do this stuff for a little while, even, you start to have weird and interesting things happen. And it was entertaining as anything just to be talking about this stuff. And I thought, oh, there's an opportunity to collect these. And I didn't really know what that would look like. I think I proposed a couple of conference panels where we would just get together and talk about these things, and that didn't happen. And so, you know, we talked up front about Interviewing Users, my first book. And one of the things that Rosenfeld Media, you know, encourages is kind of having a book that grows beyond the printed form. I mean, that just represents a point in time. And I started to think, that one of the things I want to tell people about research is you can learn to do it better. You can read this book and you can practice it. But one thing to do is just tell stories to other people about what happened. And I thought, okay, I'm going to create a repository for that. And so as Interviewing Users is kind of going to press, you know, there's a link in that book. I realized, that link needs to have stuff there so that when the book comes out and people type that URL in, they're going to get to some amount of stories, and then that will start to generate more interest. So I worked pretty actively to solicit stories. I mean, you know, it's one thing to have a repository for it, but they don't just come over the transom, as they say. You've kind of got to go and ask people, like, hey, here's this project. Here's the goal. These are stories about researchers, not about the research. Do you have anything to share? And so, right back in whenever that was, I just spent what seemed like a long time just really, you know, beating the bushes for stories. And, you know, now I think it's a little easier to get stories because many, many people have them. But, you know, it's in book form. It's kind of established. It is a thing. So it's a little easier now. But I'd love to see it continue. I'd love to see it sort of be self-sustaining. It doesn't need to be my archive, but I'd like to see people just being willing to share stories with each other for the value that can bring. So, you know, I, I'm leading that, of course, as part of these kinds of conversations and things I'm doing around the book. But ideally, people pick this up and think, oh, yeah, we should have a little lunch meetup at my company, or I should go have coffee with somebody in the community and just share stories, because I think there's so much that can happen from that.
Right. I mean, it seems like it's an oral education, most of the part, like these stories that they're passed down, because it's things that you don't really find in a how-to book, you know, like your instructional book. It's like, hey, these are, you know, maybe like have an apprentice or like master, like someone will tell you like, oh, this is what you should avoid, or, you know, it's not something that you would written down. So like just to have a physical representation of this, and not just like a one-off entry in someone's blog that collects dust, you know, the virtual dust out there that no one really reads, but just, it seems like you've created this home for people to like share their user research stories and stuff. I think that's, you know, and you said like, hey, it's, you know, it's a non-judgment zone, so don't worry about that. You can share these stories. And I feel like that's where, I think from the web development side, web design side, when I talk about my book, just like, but like there's still, you know, even though we say fail, it's, there's still some shame involved and people don't really want to share their stories. So you collect all these stories, and then stories, I feel like the stories themselves, they're short, they're simple and sweet. What I like about them is that they are short and sweet, but they also have some lessons to take away from. And I felt like, how did you determine like which ones were the best ones for the book in terms of publishing rather than leaving some ones out?
Yeah. So I had this archive, maybe it was like 75 stories or something like that. I don't know what the exact number was. You know, and the book publishing process is kind of interesting, right? Because you have to write a table of contents, like an outline, before you've written the book. So, you know, I'd been talking about these stories in a less formal way. I've been doing some conference talks and kind of saying, hey, here's this story, or there's this topic, or there's this. You know, I could see what some of the groupings were. But in writing the book, I took a much more, I did a lot more analysis. And that's, you know, that's kind of stuff that user researchers love, right? You're taking all these stories, you're trying to find what are the patterns, what are the themes. So I went through and I like marked them all up and just looked at the different aspects of what was happening. What were these kind of, inflection points at which the story flipped, the inciting incident, as they say. What were some of the lessons? What were some of the contexts? So I just had this big jumble, and I started trying to organize it and say, well, what are the key things that are going on here? And so, you know, I sort of came up with a structure that was like 85% of the way there. And then I went back to the stories and started kind of slotting them in and looked at, you know, how well did they match? At that point, you have a few stories that don't fit anywhere. So I kind of went back and forth with my editor, like, does the story go in? And you're like, yeah, that story's okay. There were some that just didn't fit, or they didn't seem as compelling for the way the book was shaping up. And then, of course, the structure evolves and you realize, oh, it's actually about this. And so now the story goes here. And then the thing that happened was, you can see we're light on a couple of areas. Like there's a really important theme, but we only got one story about it. So you can't really make a chapter around that. So I had to go out and try to find some stories that would fit into some of those topics, which was also really fun. So there's this Venn diagram I won't try to draw with my hands, but, you know, stories in the archive and stories in the book, they're pretty close, but there's some stories that exist only in one realm or only in the other. And then as new stories come in, then of course that, you know, the diagram will kind of shift. Yeah, that was kind of the process.
Do you feel like that was, that serves the stories better? Or like, do you feel like that's, you know, because like the book writing process is kind of a weird process. Cause you have an idea for the book, and then it's like, well, you know, you have to write that table of contents like you mentioned, and then you're just like, oh man, I'm actually crystallizing my idea. And that's kind of scary and fun at the same time. So do you feel like the stories were better served going this way? Or do you feel like, you know, maybe I mean, maybe just try and put a square peg in.
Yeah. So, you know, I was never going to do this as a book anyway. And then someone said, oh, you should publish them. And I thought, oh, maybe I will publish them, you know. And the motivation for that was thinking that I like to think about a dusty blog post or a dusty web page. They all were online, but they were hidden because that's just kind of how like blog content sort of disappears. So I thought I had this repository, but what I had was a bunch of old blog posts. And so I thought, okay, just kind of concatenating them into print and putting them out in the world will give that archive sort of a physical representation, and people can kind of experience it that way. I just imagine this as sort of the simplest project, like sequencing them, maybe writing a little bit about, like when you read like an anthology of science fiction or something like that, there's a little bit at the beginning that says, you know, who this author is and where the story came from, but there's not a structure to it. It's just concatenated. That's not such an appealing prospect to book publishers. In fact, you know, I had great conversations with Lou at Rosenfeld Media, and he said, well, I think there's actually a bigger book in there, Steve, if you want to put the work in to do that. And, you know, my thought was, well, I don't want to put the work in to do that. But he had a good vision for it, that there was more to be found here. And that what people want to purchase is the author's voice, and that's me. So he kind of assigned me a greater role than concatenator, if that would be a role. You know, again, I kind of resisted that, but once I started doing it, once I saw what these groupings were, and I realized I could make every chapter deals with a theme, but it starts with an essay by me about that theme with some, well, they're all different. They kind of pull from pop culture. They pull from science. They pull from my own research experience, and they kind of set up the frame of those stories. And then there's takeaways for each of them. So, you know, your question was, are the stories better served? I've always felt like the stories themselves were, like every time I would get a story and publish it, I felt like, oh, this archive, this gestalt thing, the sum of all these stories was getting better and better and better as they were kind of just, you know, adhering around to this roughly shaped set of stories. And that not every story needed to be, oh man, that's incredible, but it still could move the collection forward. So I'm sort of less concerned with the individual stories and more about what they provide collectively. And I was failing to do that with the blog. It didn't have that, it didn't level up to that gestalt. I think the book does. So I think it serves the stories, if that's the singular, if that's the collective noun. I think it serves the collective noun of the stories really, really well, because you can just flip through and read them, but you can also pull a lot more out of them. And that was all implicit in the blog and is now explicit with the book. And does it serve the stories themselves as sort of individual entities well? I think so. I mean, people that wrote them are, for the most part, very excited to be part of this. So I don't think they feel like they were not served. I'm just gonna, as the author of the book, I'm gonna come out in favor of the effort to produce it in this form.
Yeah, I think definitely as standalone art stories, I think they live on their own. But I do like the fact that, you know, you mentioned that you have an essay before each theme. Each chapter has like a theme, and then you have an essay before, but then you have the end, the bullet points, I guess, that underscore everything. So it's taking a hold, like you actually, I think you actually kind of like Legos in a way, if you will. You know, just try to build a better point with the stories. And you know, it's, you know, what stories are about, like using stories to tell your points. And if you have stories, you know, they help sell your point better, the better for it. And if there's themes involved, I think that'd be better too. You know, and I think the, you know, and each story is different. Like, you know, I felt like, and your book, you know, it's your call in terms of managing which story goes to which theme. And so yeah, I think, you know, and no one's ever done a book like this. So yeah, so there you go. It's awesome. So there you go. It's your take on it. I do want to take a step back and maybe take a look. I do want to examine, you know, as someone not used to doing user research or not, not in that world, you know, day to day, if you will. You mentioned earlier talking about doing user interviews that you'd go out to determine what you don't know. Like, you don't know what you don't know. In terms of that, how would you, what is that leap in terms of knowing that you need to do that then? Like you say, like if a company needs to know that, they need to go out and find out what they don't know. How is that usually precipitated? Like what usually happens in that regard?
Yeah. I think there's pain felt in an organization when there are decisions that need to be made, but no... I had a client that talked about it this way. He said, we have, what he said, I think he said, I'm not going to be able to put it as well as he did. We have data, but no belief. It was something like that. So it's not like user research of various forms is not a practice. It's at many companies, it is so much far more established than, you know, back in the day when I was just a pup. I mean, it was a weird thing and no one did it. Now there's lots of activities to learn about customers and their behavior and their desires and their problems and their needs. But sometimes that stuff is sort of reactive and maybe tactical. And I think people in companies or on teams find themselves, you know, trying to solve problems, make decisions, create consensus, you know, align around an approach or a vision. And if there's nothing underneath that, then it's sort of contentious. You either have to have someone just dictate, well, we're doing this because I say, which what is that? That's known as what? Design by Steve. And I'm not the Steve in that reference. Right. So I think that it's that I see that a lot that, and so what I mean, some companies are good at kind of doing this. Sometimes they just even need some help at, like, how do we even say what the problem is? Like, what is the question? You know, and sometimes I'll have these conversations where they say some of what I just said, right? We just struggle internally. I had a company that was a technology ingredient company that said, you know, our whole business is around providing quality for these certain kinds of technical experiences. Like the one that we're having now, we already kind of did some troubleshooting around quality of audio and video, and so those kinds of things. And he said, this person that I was working with said to me, we talk in the hallway about quality, we talk in meetings, it's kind of in everything that we do. We do not have a shared belief around what quality is. So in terms of how do you market these kinds of ingredient technologies, how do you prioritize your development, you know, how do you do anything when the thing that they have been making, you know, the technology they've just been innovating on for decades and decades, it's sort of implicit. And, you know, that can get you so far, but the world changes. Right. You know, when they were innovating on quality with technical communications, this thing that we're doing or that anybody's watching this is doing didn't exist. So, you know, that conversation changes as new platforms become available and new behaviors become available. So they identified that, right? We don't know how to have the conversation internally, and we need some way of understanding that better so that we can position our products, we can drive our development, we can, you know, figure out what innovation means, we can figure out how to message and how to partner. It was really something very strategic. And you see that even in more, so that's a very sort of big picture hand wavy one, but you see it in people that have products out on the market. They have kind of a use case. I talked earlier this year. I guess, you know, it's a hot topic, so it's certainly happened to me several times. I've talked to companies that are doing streaming music solutions. There's many, many players out there. You know, we have sales numbers and number of streams and features and so on. And it's a new business, but it's not. They are big businesses that are acting with a lot of sophistication and maturity as a profession. But yet they have sort of, you know, their beliefs about what people do and why they do it are based on, you know, like people that come into those companies that have worked in the music industry for a long time, or people right. that have big streaming collections themselves, or, you know, 48,000 MP3s that they ripped themselves. And the behaviors outpace their understanding. So it's, you know, companies like that. I mean, in a behavior that, you know, you could pick any company that's providing that those kinds of tools, and you know, they are not able to keep up right now.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you see, like, we're not a Steve, like, but yeah, I would love to see what Steve would do, because, you know, not to throw them under the bus, but just as an example, like, you know, Apple Music, where they launched, I felt like it was just the biggest stumbling block I've seen, because they updated, it totally blew away their previous system of iTunes Match, which was totally, I wouldn't say crippled, it was just crumbling. And then music sharing between computers was non-existent. There was a feature that you actually share between your iPhone and your laptop, is totally done. But dang it, they didn't want you to subscribe with their front screen, like right there when you launched iTunes, you need to subscribe to their music, because then your music could come back. And then, like, well, I already bought my music. You know, why do I need a subscription for it? And I think they're still reeling from that. And, you know, with all the players out there that you know, we can mention forever, as you mentioned. But yeah, but I could definitely see where that is when you ask the for behavior. It is a big, big important thing. So, yeah, I could definitely see where you actually go out and say, like, oh, how would user research be the fact that you would go out and just, you know, in this example, just ask them how they are experiencing streaming music and see and talk to them for a couple hours about their routines? Or would user research also involve just, you know, just examining their day and just shadowing them for a day?
Those are both two good sort of, those are like good thumbnails of different methods. So there's just many, many ways that you could go about doing this. And you know, if you're going to go spend a couple hours with somebody, what are you going to talk about? Is it what they're doing? Is it why they're doing it? You know, I've done some work where we looked at people's kind of overall music consumption, and their history with that. So where did it start from? What is it rooted in? How are they doing it? You know, how is live music part of it? How is, you know, having friendships that, like, how does the social network that you're part of, and I don't mean that as a technical term, but as a sociological term, how does that play into how you consume music? You know, it's not surprising that music is a big part of identity, but, you know, so how do you kind of talk about those things with people? So even just figuring out how to have that conversation. Yeah, and, you know, right, you can have people kind of, there's a day in the life where you kind of spend the day with somebody, or there's a day in the life where you have somebody just, it's kind of a question technique. You know, walk me through your day as kind of a question. Inventory questions are like where you just have someone show you what they've got. I spent a couple hours in somebody's basement looking at the brand new room they had built to house their CD collection, which was a new CD collection. Like, and we hear about people kind of collecting vinyl, right, as sort of a new thing, but this was someone that had like flushed their entire CD collection and kind of gone to MP3s and then gone to streaming and then had rediscovered and was kind of building it back up and had this physical shrine in their house.
Wow.
It's a great example of what we didn't know that we didn't know. And yeah, so I mean, just to your point, like, there's a lot of different ways you can kind of go at it. And, you know, you know, see people's behavior, ask them to talk about their behavior, ask them to explain their history, ask them to talk about expectations for future changes to their behavior. Not because that's a guarantee of what they're going to do, but because it reveals sort of unspoken values and sort of mental models that they have that drive their behavior. And you can kind of, you know, depending on what you're actually trying to get at and what, you know, what's most pressing for the team, you know, you got to put together a set of methods that will address your, in interviewing users, I talk about the business question, which is, what is it that we want to need to decide for our business? And the research question, which is, what information is going to, from people will help us answer that? And then the research methods are, what do we actually do in order to have a perspective on that research question?
Yeah. Just to go back to the early part, it's like, you know, you talk about the people in the businesses don't know exactly what they, you know, talking about, we don't know what quality is, or we don't have a firm agreement between ourselves what the customers deem as, you know, the important issue, like in terms of quality. And so in this day and age where like you can have tracking of the user, like into like a granular level in terms of what they're doing, and with RFID tags, and you can actually see where they're going within a store, physical space. You know, it's still crucial, you know, to go out and just ask people like what's important, you know, like is, you know, that's, you know, I find that I at one level, I totally understand that. And then on a totally level, it's like you have all this information, yet you just don't know how to ask the right question. And the other side is just like, it's a simple question to ask, you know, just like how's your day? Like, what are you doing with this day? And just, I feel like that's, it's a contradiction almost, like in a way, just like it's easy to understand, but also it's kind of complex in this day and age when we can track everything about a user.
Yeah. And what, you know, interviewing is great for is to try to understand why. And I think some of the teams that I've talked to do a really great job at taking their big data and identifying from that the gaps and then, you know, filling that in. Well, so we know that people are, we found these sort of surprising behaviors or curious behaviors or ones that we want to try to change in order to accomplish some goal for our business. People are doing X when they hit our site and Y when they with our app, and you know, that's not what we want. So what's going on there? And so then, you know, yeah, how was your day? Why are you doing this? How do you use it? What is value does it bring? What would be different? What's your, you know, that starts to give you some perspective on what you're seeing in the data, this big data that you can, you know, instrument. And it's great to when they can work together. I don't think it's an either or. It really is a yes and. And you can go the other way too, right? You can, you know, do a more open-ended interviewing kind of exploration and find these behaviors and then go to see what evidence you have for where that's happening or where it's not happening and sort of try to either prove it out or you know, again, it's just triangulating from different sources.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, I definitely agree. Like, you definitely want those in tandem because, you know, if you, you know, definitely, like, you know, we'll see people will say one thing and then actually do another thing.
Yes. And yes.
I guess that's the hard part is actually trying to explain why humans are those type of creatures. So.
And that's the classic user research question, right? Is like, you know, we look at what people do, what people say about what they do, and what's different between those. And so, you know, that's another reason to go out to where people are, because some of what you learn doesn't come from literally the words that come out of their mouth. It comes from the way that they say it or what they don't say or how they contradict themselves later on in the interview. Because what I would say to you in 5 minutes is different than what I would say to you after 2 hours. It comes from, you know, the other member of the household that kind of like swings by and says something. It comes from what you see in their environment. So you're given a lot of other kinds of cues to be able to try to answer the question that you just posed, which is like, why does people's behavior differ from what their stated behavior is? And a lot of it is about, you know, putting forth your best face and trying to present yourself well to somebody. And it's fascinating when you sort of stumble on a behavior or a usage activity that you never would have thought of as something that people would want to manage other people's impressions of. But you realize, oh, your tool is actually, you know, inviting people to be presented as success or as failures to the rest of the world, and that you're not, you're not empowering them to be successful in these other softer levels, and that's driving them to not do something. So you can sort of dig into what the data isn't telling you, but it requires sort of listening and filtering down to these other levels to really have a point of view about that.
I guess to filter out that way, do you figure out how many, I was reading these stories and some people were, again, coming from someone who's from the outside looking in, some of the stories began we're in day two of our 3-week study, and then we're into, just reduced, interviewing 5 people or whatever like that. How do you determine the scope, to make sure that you have enough of this, research to say I can actually make a decision now? Because one story, I forget the title of it, was that they were in day 3 of this, and they were, it's the first paragraph of the story, so kind of leading up to setting the stage for the story. But you'd say they were in a kind of dire straits a little bit, because it was the first few days, it was a slog, and they hadn't gone anywhere yet, any desired feedback. I forgot the phrase that they used, but basically it was we haven't distilled any information
to
our client. So how do you know enough time is enough time? How did that person know they had something to take back to the client, or enough to take back to their office and figure it out?
Right. Researching it. If that's the story that I'm thinking of, it's, I think, the last one by Steve Sato, who talks about being in a village, I want to say in Kenya or something. And so, the delta between the team's life and the life that they were trying to understand was pretty enormous. So I think you need to do more work to try to understand, I can't remember if it was about mobile money or what it was about, but if you're me or you, and we have our professional lives as we have, and we need to have some deep insight about how people are moving mobile money in villages in Africa, that's going to take more effort than to learn about, how are people using streaming music. I mean, it's just, you have so much more context that is, that's great. You have so much more context to try to get a handle on. So they, I think, invested heavily in doing that. They sort of knew in the planning that we don't know anything. We don't even know, how to meet with these people, how to talk with them. If you can sort of stage a project logistically, we can sort of envision how we're going to do it. Then maybe less is required. But how do you learn to scope it? The anthropologist's answer is, you stop doing research when you start getting repetition, which is sort of maybe if you are, depending on how you sort of plan these projects, maybe you can just do that. I work as a consultant, so I need to write a statement of work and put together a project plan and, get people to commit to something. Part of that is a lot of work in trying to understand what are the constraints, how much do we know, how much do we not want to know. Sometimes we need to do research in 2 different cities, for example, because that might be a logistical constraint. Oh, the team is all in this city, so we need to do it there. Or this city is a, the usage behavior is going to be really weird there because it's Los Angeles and everyone drives, or it's New York and everyone commutes on the train, or whatever it is. I think the planning studies over and over and over again, you start to understand what these constraints are logistically, and how much is kind of enough. I think over time, I've tried to do smaller studies. I mean, way back when, I remember being involved in a study of 30 families and how much they did printing or something. And it just was a lot. It just took weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks to do it. I guess two other points I want to make around this. I don't like to get drowned in the data. Like if I can't remember everyone's name or who said whatever, if I can't sort of keep my, if it's not a unit that I can sort of, I can't keep everything in my head. Like it's very rich, nuanced data that you have to go back through in detail. But if I can't sort of keep the structure in my head, you know, at like 15, 16 people, that's a lot of names. It's a lot of anecdotes just to kind of keep your head around it. When we want to do a lot more research, then you just, then you should do multiple phases. You know, do something, see what you've learned, see what your conclusions are, go back out. You know, it's that repeat and iterate kind of cycle. And then another sort of adjacent point, which I think influences this issue of sort of how much is enough. I know I hear people saying, I did this. I came back from one interview, interview three, interview four, interview one, whatever it is. And here's the insights from that interview. And I think that's sort of lazy and slightly dangerous language because it says that an insight is something that happens in a single interview. And I think, like we talked about collective nouns before, like, you know, with these stories in the book, that to me is what the, where the insights come from. Like you get provoked, you get things to think about, you have sort of suspicions, stuff happens from interview three and interview seven and interview two. But you don't know what the insights are until you go through a more rigorous synthesis process and go back and kind of take these things apart and see what the patterns were and see what actually happened, which is different than what you remember happening. So yeah, you need enough that, and so what happens for me is like at the three quarter mark is I start to be like, some of that starts to happen anyway for me. Because I'm starting to kind of accumulate a bunch of experiences, that I'm not sort of bubbling up unit insights, but they are starting to feel kind of aggregates. So I think over time you start to learn what that is. And it's, you know, for me, it's like numbers between 8 and 16 is a lot of data, when you're kind of out talking to people. So like, after hand waving and saying, "Oh, it's complicated," like I still can give you a range that where it sort of ends up pretty often for me.
Yeah, yeah. I just I feel like that was the you know, in grad school when I did analysis, so like trying to use your, you know, user experiences. It's like you just need to talk to five people for when you did card sorting, and then by fifth person, you pretty should have a idea, do some analysis on what they came up with. You should have a good idea what to make, and so you shouldn't have to, like, you know, it's like why five? I don't know. Like it just usually happens. If you go seven, you probably like just waste your time. You already have the information that you need to, or there's something actionable information to go back and before you do another phase, like you mentioned. So
it reminds me of that that Nielsen diagram that I absolutely despise, that I think has been showing for decades, that explains that you only need four people to do usability tests.
Oh yeah.
And I think, you know, it maybe intuitively it's true, but there's sort of a hubris in presenting that. It basically shows a number of participants versus amount of insight. And it, I think he kind of shows like a, you know, it tracks this way and then at four it flattens. There's no units on it. It's just sort of a visual representation of a rule of thumb. But yet by putting in a graph, it's sort of, therefore it's provable because we have numbers around it. And yeah, so right. Five people for a card sort, you start to have a good sense of what's going on. And you can kind of go back and do some analysis. Eight people in the field, depending on if you're in Kenya or if you're in three different markets in the US or whatever your topic is, you start to have some handholds around this stuff. It's certainly, it's not 100 and it's not 2, right? I mean, you can sort of see how it breaks at these extreme endpoints. But, you know, I think with experience, you start to learn how exactly to scope for this particular thing that you're dealing with.
Right. Yeah. I guess the more you're out of sync culturally, or, you know, if you will, I just want to use that expression, like the more time you'll need to take in terms of to learn the insights you mentioned. So,
yeah, I agree. But,
yeah. Cool. Yeah, and I just keep on flashing back to seeing Arrival and like the trying to learn the language, the alien language, and stuff like that too. So, But in terms of like how long it takes to learn that that new language, so that too. So cool. Awesome. I think it's a good stopping point because we mentioned movies. So instead of the book is, I want to make sure, Doorbells, Danger, and Dead Batteries, User Research War Stories. How can people get this book?
Yeah, they can find the book at Rosenfeld Media. Sells this and many other books, including my first book. And I think this is true. If at Rosenfeld Media, if you buy the print, you get the digital copy as well. You can also go to Amazon. You can buy an Amazon. You can buy either or the print or the digital copy, or you can pay twice. So those are kind of the two main places I think to get it. I think it's an iBook, although there's some discussion of that. But those are the two main. On Twitter, I'm at Steve Portugal. On the web, I'm portugal.com. Yeah. You want to find me on Instagram? I don't know. Yeah. If you know my name, you can basically find me on any platform that I'm on. So,
well, thank you so much for taking time out today, and really appreciate you being here.
It's great to speak with you. Thank you.